Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.
And so when they called me to do the 50th anniversary celebration of the show, it meant the world to me because it meant like it was an apology that was long overdue. And when I told them, I said, I will come and do the show, but only if you let me speak my truth. And, you know, okay, so you're taping a show. And I know the industry, so I'm thinking, okay, we'll tape the show and we'll see how much they use. They'll probably cut it out. But they didn't. They left it all in. And I was forever grateful for that.
And that is the voice of Jane Kennedy, one of the hosts on the original NFL Today on CBS in the 1970s. She is the special guest for this year-end edition of the Sports Media Watch podcast. I'm John Lewis, and in a moment, my co-host Armand Brody and producer Derek Futterman will join me for a discussion about the end of the year at sports media before we get to our interview with Jane Kennedy, which we recorded earlier in the fall. But before we get to that, if you have not already, please subscribe to the S&W podcast feed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and more. That's where you can see all the episodes we did this year. It was a great year on the podcast, adding Armand as my co-host, and we've now done this for nearly a full year, and Derek coming along as well as a producer. So it's been a very transformative year for the podcast as we head into 2026. But before we get into 2026, let's talk a little bit about 2025. It's been a very transformative year in the business, and the media industry has always been very highly consequential in American life, but it's also something that takes its cues from American life too. And in a lot of ways, the same way that things seem to be spinning out of control broadly, which I think is a sense that pretty much everybody has, regardless of their political opinions, I definitely think that the industry is kind of spinning out of control a little bit. And for all of the financial, you know, milestones and, oh, wow, look at all these great ratings and look at all these big personalities, it sure seems like that it's Homer Simpson asleep in his car, you know, riding down the street as I guess, you know, if you remember that particular episode of The Simpsons I'm referencing, it just feels like there's nobody really in control. And one thing for sure, I would say, is that at least in regards to sports media, and Derek will probably expand on this a bit as well when we get to that point, but the industry has changed. It's not changing. It has changed. We're taping Monday, December 22nd, obviously on Christmas Day, three NFL games all on streaming services. You know, we had the entire NBA Cup knockout round. I know people like to dismiss the NBA Cup, but it's one of the league's marquee properties at this point. All of that was on streaming. We could see the Big Ten title game sold from linear to streaming. And we just keep seeing more and more. I mean, Netflix was as big a name in sports media in 2025 as any other company, despite the fact that it really hardly aired anything. But it's just a part of the conversation. It's in every single conversation now, and a real part of that conversation as well. So, I mean, even all the way down to the Academy Awards, which obviously non-sports programming, but very indicative of where things are heading, right? And Netflix trying to buy Warner Brothers, although obviously Paramount trying to prevent them from buying Warner Brothers. And, you know, the media industry has always been controlled by a very small number of major corporations. But I don't know, maybe it's because I was too young to be really too cognizant at the time, but it sure felt a little bit more stable when General Electric and, you know, Westinghouse were running these things. That's kind of where my mind's at as we enter 2026. And Armand, what are your feelings?
Yeah, I think instability is a good word broadly. And I also think it applies from a talent perspective. You've got talent working all over the place, doing a lot of things, like Pat McAfee, for example, who can work with WWE, and then he can work with ESPN's College Game Day. He can curse more across the board. He can also have his own show come on weekdays on ESPN, even though it's his show and not ESPN's. And then you can have Rich Eisen have a similar situation where he's licensing the show. You can also have inside the NBA move from TNT to ESPN, even though it's technically still produced by TNT Sports, but it's airing on ESPN. And I think that's really what you're seeing, where it's like, from a talent perspective, we don't really work for you. We work with you. And as a result, a lot of gray area exists. What is worthy of a suspension? What is worthy of termination? Shannon Sharp can disconnect from ESPN. He can be dropped from ESPN, but still have a very popular podcast. And I think that's another space that is interesting when you look at the whole of 2025, is that the podcast space continues to expand. Too much so, in my opinion. There are too many podcasts to keep track of. But I think it points to the, as Vince Scully would say, it's a madhouse. It is. Everybody's kind of doing their own thing. The envelope has been pushed to such a degree that there is a lot of motivation for people to get into this space and to sort of have more freedom, freedoms that they would not have had even 10 or 15 years ago. And I think that's been a fascinating observation to make relative to 2025.
That's kind of where I'm getting at in a lot of ways, where once you get to a point where things are totally out of control, you can't really stand on ceremony anymore. And for ESPN, you know, I mean, they're just openly cursing now on game day. They're just letting the expletives fly, as Kramer once said, right? And the fact is, it doesn't even really add anything. It just kind of, you know, it's just there. It's quite something. And, you know, people got upset at Andrew Marchand for pointing out that it was gratuitous and unnecessary and kind of made it seem, you know, I mean, this is a somewhat prestigious show here, right? I mean, it's your top college football studio show. And I'm not averse to cursing, but there's a time and a place, right? And, you know, just lowering the bar. You keep lowering the bar. There's no need to have a bar if everyone is kind of dying out, right? And desperate times, right? One of the things to me that is kind of hard to miss is how vulgar everything is now in the industry. So, I mean, I talked a little bit about the cursing on game day, and that's kind of part of it. But when I say vulgar, I mean like just totally lacking in subtlety. Everything is just exactly what it says on the tin, right? And everyone's motivations are just right in front of your face. There's just no extra level to it. There's no, I wonder, you know, this person might be, nope, they're just exactly what it appears to be. And that kind of plays a role here in terms of where the industry's heading, because there's, like I said, there's just no room anymore for standing on ceremony, right? One of the fascinating things about the WBD circumstance is that, you know, for all of Zaslav's very evident clumsiness, right? He is old school. He's not quite so blatant, right? Everything is really blatant right now. You know, that's the other thing. That's what makes, in my view, that's what makes Paramount a very poor fit for what Zaslav wants. I think Zaslav wants the prestige of Netflix. Paramount has no prestige, not with the Ellisons in charge. There will be no prestige at Paramount ever again, right? And the fact of the matter is, we live in a time where blatant vulgarity, metaphorical vulgarity, and some actual vulgarity too, over any kind of subtlety, any kind of prestige. And it's fascinating because we did have, preceding that, an era of a lot of kind of airs, right? And I guess, look, ultimately, you know, we don't do a lot of politics on this podcast. What I'm really talking about is the Obama approach versus the Trump approach. What was Obama? Just very kind of buttoned up, you know, professorial. And I mean, Trump is the exact opposite. And so you have, between Obama and Trump, completely different approaches. And everything in our culture has kind of extended from these two presidents. So during the Obama era, a very pretentious time, a lot of putting on airs. And now we have this time of just in your face, Fox attitude. And when I say Fox attitude, I don't mean Fox News. I mean, when animals attack. And I don't really think either of those approaches kind of meets people where they are. I think people don't like to put on airs, but I think people like to put on, you know, I'll put it this way. People don't like to put on airs, but they do like to put on pants. And right now in our society, it's like walking around like just blatantly, flagrantly disregarding any kind of standard. And I think that's melted into where the media is. And that, I'm not going to go as far as Ezra Klein did in the New York Times and say that the vibe shift is over. But I definitely think that there was a probably necessary correction to the buttoned-up culture that we had. But it was an insane overcorrection into something that I just, how in the world is this going to sustain itself in 2026 and we have a functional media system?
Yeah, I'm with a lot of what you just said, because I've often felt that sports media sort of takes certain cues from culture and from the political arena, because sort of who's in office oftentimes does sort of dictate the flow of the culture. And there is a flow, and I'll use that word, there is a flow that is taking us to a very sort of meat and potatoes place, a very raw place. And to me, the hope, now this is the old school in me, I guess, the hope is that people who know how to tell stories, because a lot of what we're seeing in sports media from a talent perspective is the loss of quality storytelling, because everybody has an opinion. Everybody wants to say something. They want to offer up a take, but that's not a story. And so in 2026, some of the most valuable people in the industry are going to be the people who know how to tell a story. That means saying things that maybe others don't want to hear or don't want to be told, don't want to be released, don't want to be spoken, that may get certain people in positions of power, whether it's a conference commissioner or a league or whatever, in certain hot water. But those people are still going to be valuable because everybody's saying stuff, but a lot of the stuff is just a regurgitation and it's packaged in a coarse way. And so I think it's going to be that much more important going forward to make sure that we're plugged into those who can tell real stories in sports media and not just offer takes.
The word you just used, Armand, I think to me is perfect. Coarse. This, I've been trying to get that into my mind. You know, very coarse, right? And just, I don't think that most people were looking for Roseanne singing the national anthem to be the way everything is. And the idea that your choices are between Diane Chambers annoying everybody at the bar and Roseanne singing the anthem, I just don't think those are the two choices.
Because of what you just said, John, the most important things that are going to exist in sports media are the games themselves. Because of everything you just said, everybody's talking, everybody has a take, everybody has something to say. Because of that, the only thing that's going to ultimately matter in most cases is the game, because the game is going to be the story, because everybody's going to have something to say ahead of that. But the thing that's going to bring folks to the same place at the same time, no matter what side they're on, no matter what piece of culture they are embracing, the game is going to be the thing. And so that just magnifies the need for the streamers and the traditional networks to have quality game content, because that's what's going to be the best story that will unfold before us. And that'll be the case for many years to come.
And as we think about just a few of the other key themes throughout sports media this year, there was that major Disney YouTube dispute. The issue of ingestion has been a key thing across streaming platforms. We've seen NBC now launch a channel of its own, NBC Sports Network, to kind of allay this Peacock exclusive events to provide some more incentive for the distributors. That is a major storyline this year. I think another key thing with sports media can kind of be summed up with a few names here. So I'm just throw them out. Pablo Torre had a really big year for Meadowlark Media with his storytelling holding people to count. ESPN bringing on Katie Feeney as a content creator and investing more in social media with SportsCenter for You on the ESPN Unlimited app. And then the last thing I'll say is kind of the refreshing nostalgia of NBC and the new NBA media rights deal. The opens from Bob Costas, Marv Albert, coming back to do narrations. Very big. It was a good breath of fresh air for nostalgia. And of course, the return of Round Ball Rock, the Laser Peacock. So it was good to kind of see the NBA turn this corner. And with that came the end of the NBA on TNT. So a major shift in how basketball is being covered at the same time. But I think what all of this comes down to is that everyone is trying to find new ways to engage with this audience, storytelling-wise, trying to find new ways to connect. And the more it's able to do that in an economical way, the better, because the traditional studio programming, besides going by the wayside of Hot Takes, is also simply just becoming expensive. And I think we're going to see more and more networks begin to cut from that. Don't forget, this also marked the end of Around the Horn on ESPN this year, an institution on that network. While PTI remains the same, ESPN has now opted to go with SportsCenter instead in that 5 p.m. slot, and I'm not sure I see that changing anytime soon, because the ratings seem to be up. So we'll see what happens, but I think just a real transformative year for storytelling as a whole and how we're doing it in this business.
One thing for sure, because I said that course was the right word to go back to our earlier conversation, Armand, but I think the right word is Shameless, right? I never got into that show, by the way, with William H. Macy. I never really got into it. It's an era of shamelessness. And I guess as times become desperate, you become shameless, right? The Donner Party devolved into eating each other, right? Times got desperate. They could no longer stand on ceremony. They had to revert to their animal instincts. And that's kind of where the industry is. All right. Well, let's go ahead and discuss our predictions for 2026. And Armand, I'll start with you.
I'm cheating a little bit because I just wrote a column about it, but Al Michaels will not retire, but Amazon will choose to not bring him back, and he'll be forced to end his legendary broadcast career in 2026.
Not a bad prediction. Al is 81. It is miraculous that he can do what he's doing. I know people who didn't make it to 80. You know what I mean? I know people who didn't make it to 80, period, and didn't make it to 80 with their faculties, right? So to me, the fact that Al is doing what he's doing is incredible. And with play-by-play, you know, he's doing okay, but you can tell it's just not the same. You can tell he's not at 100%, let's put it that way. And as long as that's going to be the case, Amazon can do better. They've got Ian Eagle on their payroll. They've got Kevin Harlan on their payroll. There's a million people they could get who could do that role. And I don't want Al to retire because I enjoy the fact that Al Michaels is still doing games. But, you know, I think it makes sense if they want to move on. And, you know, for Al, I mean, he got 4 extra years of his career after NBC parted ways with him. I don't think he would be getting a raw deal.
So this could be a little outlandish. It's not based on any reporting whatsoever, but a prediction just off the top of my head for the new year. The NFL will exercise its change of control provision for Paramount to renegotiate its media rights contracts, and within those renegotiations, it will carve out an international package of games given to Netflix. That would be my biggest prediction, that Netflix increases its relationship with the National Football League after 2 seasons of doing Christmas Day games. Despite what you're hearing about eventizing, I think one thing that we've learned is when Netflix speaks publicly, don't believe them.
That's fair. That's fair. I think that would be certainly interesting. You know, Paramount, they're swaggering around, knocking all the toys over in the playroom. And I still look at this company and I say, this is just Paramount, but with 2, you know, abrasive people running it. I don't necessarily know how much they will be beloved by everybody. The pushback that they're receiving trying to get Warner Brothers tells me a lot. And so it'll be interesting to see if maybe, I mean, is Paramount the same question for the NFL will be the same question for Warner Brothers. Who do you want to do business with, Paramount or Netflix? There's no sane person, given the choice between the business of Paramount and the business of Netflix, who would choose Paramount. And I mean, what WBD said in its statement the other day was everything, right? This is a, what, $15 billion market cap company in Paramount, $400 billion for Netflix? What is this, a joke? There's no comparison between these 2 companies. So, you know, that would certainly be interesting. I don't really have a prediction, realistically. I mean, there's nothing that's kicking around in my mind. So I'll just say something. If it comes true, then I'll look brilliant. But how about between McAfee, Stephen A., one of the 2 won't be working for ESPN at the end of the year. How about that?
I love it. I'm almost upset that I didn't say that. I love it. I've been thinking it for a while, but I love that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we'll see what happens. You know, I hope it's a good year because, I mean, come on, how many more years do you really have, right? You want them all to be good. But we do have more to do in this podcast. We have our interview coming up with Jane Kennedy, one of the foundational members of the NFL Today in the 1970s. She joined the show as a replacement for Phyllis George on the NFL Today and there for a couple of years. And she goes into detail in her book, Plain Jane, which came out this fall. I know this podcast isn't coming out until after Christmas, but if you're looking for, you know, any late Christmas gifts or anything other than that, you can pick it up for yourself. Plain Jane is available in bookstores, and Jane Kennedy is also out on her book tour, or at least was earlier in the fall. And we talked to her. It was just Derek and I. Armand wasn't able to be there, but when we're done with the interview, we will talk to Armand about his thoughts on what Jane Kennedy had to say. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. It is the final interview of the year. Jane Kennedy on with Derek and I.
Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Graham laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Graham keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Graham laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.
We are very honored to be joined by a TV pioneer. This is someone who was on the original NFL Today back in the days of Brent Musburger and Jimmy the Greek, Irv Cross. We are talking with Jane Kennedy, who is here promoting her new book, Plain Jane, and very kind to take the time to talk with us today. And Jane, it really is an honor to be joined by you.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm glad to be here. I appreciate you asking me to join you.
This is the 50-year anniversary of the NFL Today. Obviously, we had all the festivities about that earlier in the year. And to be part of sports media history in that way, to be part of really a groundbreaking show in so many different ways, can you just speak to that experience and what it means to you all these years later?
It's definitely a groundbreaking show. Many have said it's the best sports show in the history of sports television. Pre-game sports show, I should say. Bob Costas had said that we were far surpassed, and it was because it introduced the idea that it was live television. And live had not been done before. If you were a sports columnist, you know, you had to wait for your article to come out in the paper regarding the game the next day. And so now here you have broadcast journaling, but we didn't have live. So in terms of, you know, like if someone is Detroit and they want to know what the weather is for the Miami game, you know, they can turn on and watch the NFL Today. And we would have the flags flying around the stadium and would tell you what direction the flags were flying. And a lot of that had to do with a lot of reasons other than the fact that it was a television show. But it was definitely the first of its kind.
And you were there for 2 years reading your book this week. It was very interesting to kind of see some of the difficulties that you dealt with at the end. You're doing the Super Bowl and they're basically kind of already bringing in the person that you replaced, Phyllis George, to come in. Did that at all create an embittered memory about the show for a while? And if so, is that something that's faded over the years?
Of course it did, because not only did they fire me, but they tried to tell everybody that I left, that it was my choice, that I left the show. So that not only left me with no job, but a bad face in the eyes of the American public. And this was an audience that had grown to respect me on my presence on the NFL Today. I fought for that job, and I was the first African-American woman to ever do a sports broadcast, the second woman to ever do a sports broadcast that was live. And to this day, it's honored and hailed as one of the best shows in television. And this is because we did something that other people did not do on the show. So to take that away from me hit hard, because I really tried my best to do everything that I can to be my best on the show. I loved it. I would travel crazy. I lived in Los Angeles while I was working in New York. But the commute, you know, was, yes, it was crazy, but I loved it. And then during the middle of the week, you found me going off to different parts of the country, which were most of the time east of the Mississippi River. So, you know, there I was Friday night, Saturday, Sunday in studio, and then Tuesday, Wednesday in some location with an NFL team. and then back home to Los Angeles again, Friday night back to New York. So, you know, it was a crazy schedule, but I bought that, you know, and I owned it. I knew that this would make a name for me. I'd been in the industry for 8 years before that. And a lot of people thought that it was my first day of ever setting foot on a stage. But I had been in the industry for 8 years doing television, feature films. I'd been on the road with the Dean Martin Dingaling Sisters for 3 years as a singer-dancer. I was on the Bob Hope Bases Around the World Christmas Tour, singing and dancing for the troops in Vietnam during the Vietnam War. And we traveled all around the world to get circle back home, coming through Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. And so, you know, I had a lot of experience behind me, but not in broadcast television. And then when I asked them to assist me, you know, like, okay, what's it like working in a newsroom? No help whatsoever. They put me in the studio the very first day on camera. And on top of that, my very first interview ended up being scrubbed by the tape machine. And I had to fill for 3 minutes live in the television show on my very first venture into sports broadcasting. So yeah, I fought like hell for that job. And I absolutely loved it. And it was not right that they stole it from me and then tried to make it sound like it was my fault.
Jane, what was the inspiration for you to write this memoir? I know Oprah had something to do with it and that it was a long process. Just wondering, like, where the inspiration came from to share your story in this form.
Well, the inspiration came from many different sources. I'd been told since the mid-90s that I should write a book because this career that I had set as my path was very unique. There were so many amazing people in my journey, along the journey. And it was definitely something that a list of first, you know, so it was definitely something that would be appealing to a reader. But then it took so long, it took me 25 years to finish because I wanted it to be my living process piece. I didn't want it to be only about sports or only about entertainment, but I wanted it to be about my life, which is the first part, Jane Harrison. Second quarter, Jane Kennedy, talking about showbiz and entertainment and sports. Third quarter, Jane Overton, talking about my family and the values that I have now and my experiences in life right now. And then the last chapter would be fourth quarter, Plain Jane. And then when I got to the writing that fourth quarter, I realized that there was still more that I had to say. So then it went into overtime. So, but I learned a lot about me and I'm hoping that it can teach a lot of women, young women and people that are women that are my age, you know, that there is so much that you can do in your life and don't ever let people tell you that you can't. My company name is not done yet, which states who I am right now. And I will never let anyone stop me ever again.
I thought it was interesting. One of the things that you wrote about in the book, you talked about the maybe retrenchment of women's rights broadly in the world within the realm of sports media. How do you view women's progress and Black women's progress as well since you've been out of sports media? Do you look at the current situation as one that has improved, has maybe been two steps forward, one step back? How do you see it?
Well, you have to say that it definitely has been improved because just look at the numbers, you know, and you have these amazing women that are on the sidelines and on the desk, maybe not on the NFL Today, but back then on the NFL Today, there were only three networks. So you had CBS, NBC, ABC, that was it. So now there's so many other opportunities that will broaden the opportunities for women to participate in sports overall. But I'm overwhelmed with the talent that we have in sports broadcasting today, particularly when I see, you know, the Jemele Hills, you know, and the people that I so respect, you know, and I have to take a little bit of, you know, I brush my shoulder off, you know, take a little bit of credit for that, you know, and it's so wonderful, you know, for my book, Plain Jane, I did the West Coast launch at the California African American Museum with Jemele Hill as the host. And oh my God, that filled my heart tremendously. I don't know what it did for the audience or for Jemele, but I was so inspired that I had the opportunity to work with this incredible woman. A few months back, I did a special and it was for women's generational input in sports broadcasting. So they had me, Pam Oliver, Stephanie Reddy, and Taylor Rooks to talk about the generational aspects and how we see the evolution of women involved in sports broadcasting. So, you know, here I am and I'm talking to these women, and the one that's closest to my age is Pam Oliver. And we're talking about things, and Stephanie Reddy starts talking. And then Taylor Rooks looks at me and she says, "I never knew these things were happening." She said, "I'm thinking I can just go through life, go through my sports broadcasting life, and I can achieve this and achieve that. If I work hard enough, I can do this and this and this." She says, "And I took so much for granted that I never knew that you had to fight for back in the day." So, you know, I hope that Jane Kennedy can open the door with Playing Jane for so many other women who don't know the backdrop of what they can achieve in life. Because there's so much that there wasn't. Not only was it only three networks, there was just no way that you could get the promotion that you needed. Now you have social media. You have so many tools that you can grow a career. Back then, the only thing I had was that, I don't want to say it like it's like I'm bragging, but I felt the love of the people. I felt it when Doug Williams told me that Walter Payton had issued an edict, "We're going to take care of our Jane." I had so much support from the athletes because they wanted that as much as I wanted it. They wanted it to be a success. I remember being shown when we were taping, You Are Looking Live, and they showed me a clip of Thomas Henderson, and it was the year after I had been fired. And he was on the desk talking to Brent. And when they finished their dialogue, he looked at Brent and he said, "We miss our queen. Where's our queen? We miss Jane Kennedy." And I just cried, you know, because, oh, what can I say? For a business reason, they had taken that away. But what they didn't realize was they had made such an impact on America. That show made a tremendous impact on America and for women in general. And the fact that we could do this made it possible for all these women that followed in our footsteps.
And the NFL Today is seen as a blueprint of sorts for these pregame shows on NFL Sundays leading into the games. What made the cast, back when you were on the show, what made the cast particularly special? What made it stand out in the American fabric?
I think that Brent Musburger is a brilliant sports journalist. And he was the key. He was the key. If it wasn't working with him, the show wasn't working. And adding Jimmy the Greek was only an addition because they didn't want to hire another Black person to be on the set when I auditioned. They had decided that through the audition process, they had decided that they wanted me. And Brent had said, "It's Jane or nobody." But they had problems trying to figure out how are we going to have two Blacks on the set and one white. And this was in 1978. So they sent my audition tape to the Southern affiliates, and the Southern affiliates said, "You know, she has what we're looking for, but how we're going to fix this?" And Jimmy the Greek had been on the side. He hadn't been on the desk. He was doing his projections of what he thought the turnout of each game would be. And they said, "Well, if we put Jimmy the Greek on the desk, then we have two whites and two Blacks." So not only was I fighting the battle of being a female in sports broadcasting, but I was fighting the battle of being seen as a Black woman. And as a young Black woman, there were so many sports journalists that the ones that I talked about that didn't get to tell their stories until the Monday, you know, they resented the fact that here you are Sunday and you're getting out information. Now it's a woman that's getting out information before me. And now it's a Black woman that's getting out information before me. There was a lot of resentment. So years later, when the National Association of Sports Journalism called me and said, "We want to honor you." Oh my God. You could have knocked me over with a feather. I mean, that's probably one of the highest honors that I've ever achieved. You know, the fact that the National Association of Sports Journalism was giving me the prestigious Roone Arledge Award. And that to me was amazing. And then years later, I opened my social media page, and on the first thing that pops up is a guy. He had submitted a photo and tagged me in it. And he says, "Look what I saw today." And he was at the Smithsonian Museum of African American History and Culture. And there was a mural of me, Diane Carroll, the Supremes, this wall of famous people, and here I am on the desk of the NFL today. And I said, oh my gosh, and it was all the way at the end, you could barely see it. And I said, oh my gosh, I wish you had taken it from the other perspective so that I could actually see it. The next day he went back and he shot the photo and sent it to me with me on the foreground and all the other people in the background. I'm standing next to Nacky Cole. Now I'm seeing it. And my mom's one of his biggest fans, you know, and I'm saying, I got to come to DC. I called my daughter. I jumped on the first flight and I had to go see it because I had to touch it. Not only was it me on the wall, but it was on the desk of the NFL today. And it showed me how impactful that part of my life had been, not only in sports, but in our culture as well. And that was probably one of the most significant parts of my journey.
You had mentioned previously Pam Oliver, and I'd actually seen the special that you're talking about. They aired it on NBA TV, or it might have been TNT during the playoffs last year. In your position, everything you've been through, have you ever had the opportunity to really kind of offer your knowledge, your experiences, and your counsel in situations like when Pam Oliver, for example, was taken off the number one role for Fox on NFL games? That kind of, at least to me, reminds me of your situation on the NFL today. Have you ever had the opportunity to reach out to other people in the industry when they have those experiences and kind of offer your advice?
No, I have not. And I have not also had the opportunity for people to reach out to me. For a long time, people had forgotten. You know, like if you say to someone who's in their 30s, late 20s, you know, who is Jane Kennedy, they won't know. So one of the most important parts about writing the book is to set the record straight and to maybe give some insight into how Black women have shaped not only politics or not only family values, but, you know, in the world of sports, which most people attribute to, you know, the evolution of the greatness of sports should be granted to, the dignity should be granted to the men. But we women have a battle to fight. And I was just watching something on Billie Jean King earlier this morning, and I was watching her, you know, I said, you know, I remember crying, you know, when she was just doing her thing, you know, and making us so proud as women in the world of sports. I grew up, I was pre-Title IX. There were no opportunities for me to participate in sports. So, you know, to be able to achieve this and then to be honored, you know, and get the acknowledgement and support, that's all you need. You know, it's not about seeing yourself as someone special, because I've never seen myself as someone special. I just wanted to be respected. And to be able to earn that respect meant all the world to me. And in answering your question about helping others, you know, I've tried to do that, maybe not in the world of sports broadcasting, but, you know, I've reached out to many, many young women that have come along in the generation of my daughters. And I've helped them, you know, I said, you know, you can be so great, and whether it's playing sport or whatever they wanted to do. I coached girls soccer for 12 years. I saw these 8-year-olds playing AYSO, and I said, oh man, you guys should be in club soccer. And I put them together and I called their moms, and they all came to a meeting, and I said, look, I know club soccer is expensive. I will try to find a way. I will make a commitment that I will find a way so that your girls can play in club soccer. And we ended up winning so many state championships, national championships. And these girls went on to play college on full ride scholarships. So, you know, the fact that women in sports, you know, can grow during my lifespan, I've been blessed to be able to witness that, instead of being someone who's, you know, just hovering in the 2020 to 2025 era and thinking that it's all about now. It's not all about now. And we can never forget that. We can never allow that to be forgotten.
When you see some of what we see now, I mean, you talk about growth of women in sports, and obviously you can talk about, I mean, the existence of a WNBA, for example. But in sports broadcasting, we now see a number of women in roles that would never have been considered. You can go all the way back to hosting studio shows like, you know, Hannah Storm did throughout the 1990s. But more recently, actual play-by-play And we see that with, I mean, any number of people, including, I think, Zora Stevenson just today is reported to be in line to do the WNBA play-by-play for NBC next year. These are things that, and I can see the smile on your face and, you know, the pride that you feel in it.
Oh, my heart's thumping, but I'm ready to jump out of my chest.
Well, I mean, I'll give you the floor. I mean, what does that mean to you?
Everything, you know, because you always want to be able to work and achieve a goal, no matter what that goal. If you just want to be able to, you know, to lift weights, if you want to just be able to lift 100 pounds, we all have goals. But some of these goals, they were not possible and not available to a lot of people for a long time. My thing is that why did it take so long? That's what I don't like. You know, here we are, you know, and I'm looking at so many young women that are still trying to make their way and they're still being told no. They don't say that it's because of a bias, because of feminism, but we still have that. We still have that. We still have people, you know, whether it's in politics and all walks of life, we still have people that are saying a woman's place is in the home. I will never believe that. And I will never, you know, one of the reasons that I always wanted to do this journey of playing Jane was to show my daughters the way that I felt. You know, they saw me as mommy. They knew what a fighter I was. They knew that I was always going to have their back. And I got to say, I have four of the most amazing daughters. I'm so proud of each and every one of them. Not one of them has failed me at one point in their lives, not one. And so, you know, I've always said, I can't fail them. And so be able to write this book and then for them to see the path that I have carved for many women their age. You know, I see some of the kids that have gone to school with Zaire, who graduated from USC. Here she is doing politics, covering politics and news in Washington, D.C., and, you know, landing jobs on ABC, NBC, CBS. And I'm so proud of them, you know, just to know that even if it wasn't me directly, the fact that I had an impact, that's worth everything. That's worth everything.
Talking about the Muhammad Ali role, you know, you devote a whole chapter of your book to your friendship with Muhammad Ali. You talk throughout the book about the trust that some of the most iconic athletes, not just of that era, but of any era, had in you. And they would maybe not do an interview, or they would not be interested in doing an interview until they heard that you were doing the interview. And then they were interested. How did you build that trust with, again, some of the great icons in the history of American sports?
Well, there's several reasons why that would be true. Number one is it wasn't a matter of building trust, but it was a matter of having an already existent friendship. Ali and I had been friends before that, so it was easy for me to give him a call. But the fact that it was a small community back then, I think that that played a big part in, especially for African Americans that were trying to not only open the door for themselves, but for other people. So I think that that was one of the big reasons why I was able to garner the respect and responsibility of doing my job well. When I was doing Greatest Sports Legends, and they had been trying to get an interview with Bill Russell for years, and he had always denied it. So when they called again, when I was signed to do as the first woman to ever host the show, and usually they would do one host per year, they would change every year. I worked there for 6 years. So, you know, there was a lot of respect, not only with the athletes, but also with the ownership, which I highly respected them for doing that. But, you know, they booked Bill, they called Bill Russell, and he said, yes, I'll do it. And they had never had him on the show before. They were shocked. So here we are, you know, and we're doing the show. And then before we started, I said, I have to ask you, why did you say yes when you've turned it down so many times? He said, because you're building a legacy and I want to be a part of making that happen. And so it was a respect with Walter Payne saying, we're going to take care of our Jane. With Bob Johnson at Johnson Publishing, we're going to take care of our Jane. And they always use that word, our Jane. You know, I was making a way for women to, I was carving a path for African-American women and African-American men to be respected with dignity and to be treated as equal. And I acknowledged that and I accepted that. When I have Bill Russell telling me that I'm going to be building a legacy, I didn't know what that meant. All I knew was every day I put one foot in front of the other and I just kept walking and I had to keep opening the doors. You know, like I didn't think of it as a job. My job was to do my work on the set. It's in retrospect that I acknowledge the legacy that Bill Russell was talking about. It's in retrospect that I understand what the African-American athletes would say, when Jane wants an interview, we do the interview. But it wasn't just that. It was that I knew what I was doing. So we had also, Terry Bradshaw was doing an interview with Phyllis George the year after they fired me. And he's sitting in, I look like a restaurant setting, and he's sitting there waiting. And Phyllis walks on into camera and she's sitting down and she's talking, and he's not talking. And she says, what are you doing? And she says, I'm waiting for Jane Kennedy. So I mean, you know, I don't know. I don't know what it was. I was just riding the waves, enjoying the ride, and acknowledging that there was something special underway, which is why I'm doing this book, because I'm not done yet.
Jane, when you think about the legacy that you've left, what do you feel you have left to add to your legacy? What are you looking to do from here on with the book and further? What are you looking to do down the road?
It's a good question. I do have a fragrance because I'm looking at being multi-purpose this time outside of the entertainment industry. Back in the 80s, you know, when I did the Lovely Body exercise program, and I was one of the first. It was me, Jane Fonda, and Richard Simmons. And that whole realm had not even existed before we came on. And now, you know, we're doing infomercials and everybody started doing those. And, you know, people don't even do that now. They do podcasts. But back in the day, we had opportunities that we had to pave the way for. When they came to ask me, we're thinking about doing an exercise video and we'd like to hire you. And I said, no, I would like to do it with you, but I want to produce it. I want to be one of the writers. I want to star in it. I want to pick the cast. And I said, I'm willing to work with any version of it that you think would be possible. But, you know, I'm having my say on this one because I had been through too much to be just taken for granted and be pushed to the side. So, you know, here we end up with one of the top selling programs in the country. We were the top three, me, Jane Fonda, and Richard Simmons. And I think you have to take that advocacy forward in all that you do. And I think a lot of times back in the day, way back, you would find out women who were saying, you know, I'm afraid what might happen. But now we don't have that fear anymore. If someone tells you no, then you just go to another door. Knock, knock, knock.
You know, we talk so much about how much things have changed. And in a lot of ways, things have changed for the better. At the same time, we look back at those days, the 1970s and certainly the 60s, and it's impossible for me to have any firsthand knowledge of what those times were like. But you look back at the people who were there then. We talked about Ali, Bill Russell, all the history makers and all the pop cultural figures as well, who were just, you know, you mentioned many of them in your book. That era, I mean, obviously, it was impossibly difficult in ways that we can't really even grasp now. But what was it about those times that resulted in so many special and iconic people, including yourself, being able to really congregate in the same circles and, you know, kind of draft off of each other in a time where maybe that kind of unity was especially needed?
It was most definitely especially needed. I see instantly the image of the Cleveland Summit with the athletes, Kareem and Ali. And I see all these images from the 60s when we had to struggle and we had to fight for justice. I see how we have gone forward to when I was first in Los Angeles and it was such a small community. The African-American population was such a small community back then. And we supported one another. You know, there's also the counterpart where, you know, there's an old joke. It said that there were two roommates and one of them was getting up in the morning, getting dressed, And his roommate said, where are you going? He said, oh, you know, I'm just going over to meet a friend, you know. And he said, what are you going to do? He said, oh, no, I haven't seen this for a long time. You know, I just want to look my best. I'm going over to meet my friend. What are you doing? He said, no, you know, I just, you know, got a job interview. So I'm going to go try to see if I that can work out. So half hour later, they both end up at the same office where they're casting a movie. They were both actors and they're trying to get the same role. But you didn't want to tell anybody because you were afraid that it was only one role and only one person could get that role. So you don't tell anybody else, you know, so there's that part of it too. But, you know, today we have a kindredship. I think you can call it that. And I think that as a people, we're able to see what's needed. And I don't want to talk about politics, but this is what my mind is on right now, is in this political arena right now. We're looking at people coming together in all kinds of ways, in all kinds of ways. And it's, you know, it's because when you can't keep pushing people off the curb. Eventually, they're going to stand up. And that's what I like to see. I like to see when people can work together. I like to see the growth of the community in quote unquote Black Hollywood from the time that I first landed here to where it is today, where you have so many people, you know, like back then you could have a party and everybody was at the party. Now you can't put everybody at the party because there's so many, you know, but it's so many wonderful opportunities. I mean, you know, I nearly fainted when I met Idris Elba the other day. I was, oh my God, I was fangirling all over the place. So, you know, there's just so much that's available today. And I see the doors opening even more, you know, because I tell young women all the time, don't go through life with blinders on, you know, like, okay, I'm going to do this. This is my goal. And everything is, nothing's going to, you know, steer me away from achieving this goal. Take the blinders off because sometimes there might be things on the outside of those blinders that you don't know that are supposed to be there for you. And you've just walked right past them. So I ask people to just open up their vision, open up the blinders, open up to opportunities and be well prepared to meet them. So you can't expect that people will give you opportunities and you're not fit for it. So you have to be well prepared. You have to be able to tell yourself, whatever it is in life that comes my way, I know I can do this. Whether you have to go home and learn it that day or not. My mantra back in the 60s, 70s was, if somebody asks you if you can do something, you always say yes. Then you go home and you figure it out. And, you know, I did that. I think that it's important for people to know that you have to be able to have faith in yourself. I mean, I'm speaking to the choir here, but I just know that there's so much more that we're capable of. You know, I'm so proud of, you know, people that are standing up and speaking what they believe, you know. We can't be sitting on the curb anymore.
I'm curious to get your thoughts on whether there's enough appreciation for history. And this isn't distant history. We're talking maybe 50, 60 years, talking about the 60s and the 70s. You talk in the book about the circumstance with women trying to get into the locker rooms and all the travails that were dealt with by any number of women in the 70s and 80s, just trying to do their jobs the way that the men do. Is there an appreciation among younger people for everything that had to be done to get us to where we are today? And is that lack of appreciation maybe resulting in some backsliding?
There's definitely a lack of appreciation, and it's not at their fault. It's a lack of knowledge. When you have someone that's talking about, you know, a lot of these people, I don't know if it's millennials, bilingual, I don't know that jargon, but when you have people who are in their careers and they're trying to achieve and they're making profound steps, but they don't know the history, the back history of how they were able to get there, then we have a problem. So we have people who are now saying that we have people who are in a position to make a difference. And they're thinking that they can do this for the first time. And they're acknowledging the fact that we were able to achieve this And from now on, you know, I'm going to be able to do this, this, and this, and this, and this. But they don't understand that we have tried to, we back in the day, and even before my day, the Dorothy Dandridges that were before me, that they had to make the path so that I could walk. That I had to open the path so that these people today could walk. But there's so many people that are in today's generation that have no idea what those sacrifices are. They have no idea whatsoever. And so that's why it's so important that we are able to maintain our libraries, that we are able to maintain the opportunity to create film that we have a voice in. So we're not just being told from somebody else's perspective. I was just inducted into the History Makers Museum, and I am now embedded into the National Archives. My life story, it's a 4-hour interview that they sent it to me just last week. And it's a little glass thumb drive. And I'm going to treasure that because within that is a whole lifetime of what we can possibly use going forward. I'm always forward thinking. I'm always trying to think of how can we help? You know, like when I told those young kids that they're better than playing AYSO, I wasn't digging the AYSO. I was saying that you have a gift. So how can we make that gift possible? How can we make that? And now these young ladies, they're gone on and they're remembering that. And, but you know, like, so I'm only a small web in the cog. So you have a lot of women that are able to do that. I have seen women with production deals that should be valued at far more than what they are. And I won't say who, but some of the production deals, when they, the money that they have included within their deal, they're not being treated fairly. And we still have disparity with women and men in the entertainment industry, and most likely in the sports industry as well, and most likely everywhere. So we have to still be able to get past that. I just think that we cannot stop. We have to keep going forward.
Before we let you go, you are going to be going off on a book tour to promote this book, Plain Jane. You'll be in Washington, D.C., Beverly Hills, Long Beach, Las Vegas, Chicago, Atlanta, Akron, St. Louis. So you will be out and about. And we wish you all the luck in the world on your tour. And we hope that many folks check out this book. There's a lot of really interesting sports media stuff in here for those of you who listen to this podcast and are interested in the NFL today. And if you're interested just in history, there's a lot of interesting stuff just generally about sports and entertainment. So I definitely recommend checking out Plain Jane. And Jane, it was an honor. Really appreciate it to be able to talk with someone who was at the ground floor of some of the most important moments in sports media history. Thank you.
I also have to acknowledge that we launched our tour with Robin Roberts on Good Morning America. And it's so funny because when I was trying to get a publisher for my book, I had visited and been turned down by 42 publishers for my book. And I called Robin Roberts and I said, you know what? And I didn't really know her. I just called her. And I said, you know, I'm having so much trouble trying to find a publisher for my book. If you could just give me an idea of who I should approach, let me know. And she said, okay, you know, I'll call you back. That's all she said. I'll call you back. The next morning, I wake up, my phone's ringing off the hook. Turn on Good Morning America. Turn on Good Morning America. And Robin is on GMA. And she's saying, I just talked to Jane Kennedy yesterday and she doesn't have a book deal. Are you kidding me? It must be the gatekeepers, the young people that don't know her. You know, this is ridiculous. We've got to get a book deal. Somebody in Baltimore saw it, called their friend at Disney and said, Jane Kennedy doesn't have a book deal. And she said, I can't believe that, you know, and she was the only Black in her position at her company. So she called her bosses. Next thing you know, I've got a deal with Disney. So, you know, it's a matter of looking out for one another. It's a matter of, you know, like expecting things, gifts, literally gifts to come your way when they're unexpected, and to be willing to say, let me take a step. You know, because I could have just said, Robin's not going to take my call. But I called her same way I called Ali. And, you know, when he walked in that door, you know, before he walked in the door, I had told them, I had promised CBS I was going to come back the next day with that interview. And I said, I will have it for you for your show tomorrow afternoon. This was Friday night. And here I am. And I called Ali, said, I'll leave you the key at the front desk. Meet me in my room. Crew is all set up. Camera's rolling. And I'm sitting there and I'm praying, please walk through the door. Please walk through the door. Please walk through the door. And he walked in. So, you know, sometimes the opportunities come in the least expected way. And just, you know, I tell everybody, don't go through life with blinders on.
And that Ali story, you were working for the CBS Sports Spectacular, doing some extra work for CBS. And you talk about that in the book, Plain Jane. So if you want to know more details on that Muhammad Ali story, check out the book. Jane, once again, a real pleasure. And we thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview. And Armand, what were your thoughts?
So I was struck a bit by how CBS sort of tried to make Jane look when they fired her, and to suggest that it was sort of a situation where she left versus sort of owning that. I don't think people realize, and even watching the You Are Looking Live documentary from CBS, which aired last year, Jane was a huge deal. She was a massive deal. There's the obvious appeal that she had because of her attractiveness, but just the access that she could get to a lot of these athletes and her importance to the fabric of the show was very, very critical. And then, yes, there is the piece of her inspiring a lot of African-American women, the Taylor Rooks, the Pam Oliver, the Stephanie Reddy, etc. But I was just struck by how, I mean, of course, there's been so much time to pass by now, but just her candidness of letting people know, letting us know, hey, you know, this was not a smooth transition. It was not just me sort of riding off into the sunset and giving way for Phyllis George here. It didn't end that well. And with the benefit of hindsight and time and wisdom, she was able to express that in a way that, and you asked the question, John, you know, were you bitter? She said, yeah. She said, yeah. And to own that and to express that candidly and to maybe sort of give us a perspective that the documentary did not fully give us, I'm appreciative of the honesty with which she responded and answered the questions that were asked of Derek and you.
It was a great conversation. I was happy to be able to give Jane that platform. Certainly interesting stuff there, and I hope you all enjoyed it listening as well. Well, that's going to do it for 2025 on the Sports Media Watch podcast. I'm John Lewis, and I want to thank Armand for a great year joining me as my co-host. Really appreciate it. And Derek coming in later in the year as a producer as well. It's been the best year of the podcast. A lot of great guests, and hopefully we can keep that going into the new year. But in the meantime, enjoy the holiday, and we'll be back soon enough.
Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.